Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. It's pretty clear that healthcare today is in flux. Some would say it's even in crisis. Many clinicians and patients alike are unhappy with the way their interactions are organized. We think it might be helpful to look at a different model of medical practice.
We're talking today with Dr. Pamela Weibel. She's a nationally recognized innovator in patient-centered care. She pioneered the community-centered ideal medical practice in which patients design their own clinics, and she has written a fascinating book, Pet Goats and Pap Smears. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Pamela.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Pamela, I have to tell you, everyone these days seems to be dissatisfied with healthcare. Patients feel like, you know, they're just not getting enough time to tell their story. Doctors feel that there's not enough time to listen to the story. And there was just a study recently in JAMA Internal Medicine suggesting that 40% of hospitalists, at least the ones they surveyed, say they don't have enough time to take care of patients safely. You got off the merry-go-round. Tell us why and how you did it.
Yeah, I did not feel that I could properly care for people in basically what amounts to assembly line medicine. And other doctors feel the same way, of course, which is why the physicians and the patients are dissatisfied, because healthcare is at its core about caring. And if there's no time to care, which means connecting heart to heart, soul to soul with the other person, then healing does not take place. I mean, we can approach healthcare in the reductionist, paternalistic model in which it's been handed down to us, but, you know, honestly, we're not cars needing a muffler change. We are more than our physical bodies. We are spirit. We have a heart. And these are the elements that need to be connected human to human during an appointment for people to feel that care is taking place. And that can happen in a short appointment. You don't necessarily need a long appointment to connect at those levels. I'm sure we all remember times in our lives where somebody mentioned one sentence or gave us a glance or a hug that really changed our life at the right moment. So these profound experiences don't take much time. It's just that we've been taught that medicine is really a reductionist profession and that we're just little more than physical bodies.
Dr. Weibel, the type of connection that you're describing, in which people connect as human individuals, as spiritual beings, sounds a bit like the healing practices that I have read about as a medical anthropologist that were common among traditional peoples who didn't have access to modern health care, people who would use shamanism, for example, as a healing modality.
Yeah, that's correct. That's actually what people are seeking today in 2013. And how I learned this is that, dissatisfied with medicine as my patients were, I led a series of town hall meetings and invited my community to design their ideal practice. And how better to find out what patients want than to put them in charge?
You wanted to know what they wanted, so you asked them?
Right. And I didn't just ask them to tweak the current system. I told them, you know, if we could design something completely new, anything you want, you know, just throw me your wildest dreams. If you could have your ideal clinic, what would it look like, smell like, feel like? And I got 100 pages of testimony, and amazingly, I was able to adopt nearly all of it and open the clinic in 1 month.
So, Pamela, what do people want?
People want the number one thing that keeps coming up, and this is city from city across the whole country, not unique to Eugene, Oregon, is they want a human experience. You know, after all, health care is about treating a human being. And if the healer or the doctor is not able to be human themselves, then we're missing 50% of the equation. And unfortunately, we've been trained to be really good at reductionist medicine. That's moving fast, dealing just with the human body. And so we miss, you know, the other two-thirds.
Well, actually, not even the human body. I mean, what we hear so much these days is the gallbladder in room 214.
Body parts.
Yeah, and not just body parts, but cholesterol levels.
Right. Lab tests. Numbers.
Exactly.
And if charts.
If your numbers are good, then, hey, you're good to go. If your numbers are bad, we've got a pill.
Right, right. So when you put the patient in charge, they actually design a healthcare model that works for the patients and the physicians. I mean, it's very beautiful. And that's why I feel no struggle during my appointments. I don't have an invisible sort of algorithm that I'm trying to force people onto or hold them hostage to. I actually am in alignment with the values of my patients and my community. And thus, myself, I wouldn't have moved to Eugene, Oregon if I didn't think this was a wonderful place to live. So obviously, I resonate with the people in my town. So I would be the perfect family doctor for them. We're often attracted to the places that, you know, meet our needs. So it's just a matter of getting back in sync with one another.
Now, what we hear from so many family doctors around the country is that over the last, I guess, 20 years or so, they have experienced, this is what you would describe as assembly line medicine, they have experienced the demands of the reimbursement, the nature of reimbursement, that they have to see more patients. So first it was 4 patients in an hour, and then it got to be 5, and then it got to be 6. And it just becomes very difficult for the doctor to actually pay attention to the patient during when they feel so pressured.
And what's more, they need a whole staff of people to call the pharmacy, to double check with the insurance company, to cut through the red tape, and when there's a problem, to appeal it, and on and on. They're no longer allowed just to practice medicine the way they used to 20, 30 years ago.
So two issues there. One is that traditionally family physicians and physicians in general are in private practice, and still a large number are. And in that case, the physician actually can control which insurance companies they're contracting with. So you would never contract to be in a relationship, for example, a marriage that involves domestic violence, for example. I mean, there are certain relationships that are actually not of service to belong to, right? So there's certain contracts with insurance companies that are abusive, you know, that demand far too much from the physician and the patient and are actually demeaning of their relationship, you know? And so you're inviting a third party into the room that could, in essence, destroy the sacred relationship between the physician and the patient. Now, I still take insurance. 80% of my patients are insured, and I have no problem dealing with these insurance companies because I contract with responsible insurance companies that do not hassle me, that do not make unfair demands on me or my patients. So I have none of those things that you listed, you know, and yet I still deal with insurance. So some of this is a willingness on the part of physicians to be in relationships that victimize them. Now, when you're an employee of a larger group, you have less control. And unfortunately, a lot of physicians are made to feel that, oh, it's impossible to be in solo practice. That's something of the past. And you have to join with these bigger groups. And these bigger groups, again, will not ultimately serve the needs of the patients or the physicians, unless, you know, the physician enjoys being there and it's a maybe tertiary care center where you do need a huge team and you need that sort of a setting. But for most primary care, which is 99% of what people need, when you listen to just American citizens at town hall meetings, they want these smaller, cozy, human-scale offices.
And, of course, primary care is where we have the greatest need at this point and the fewest people going into primary care. These are...
And that's correct, because people, you know, the students who come to my office every week to learn from me, they tell me, oh, you're the first happy doctor we've ever met. Or you're the only solo doctor we've ever met. We keep getting told in medical school that's impossible. And so what we've lost are our teachers. You know, we've lost a generation of doctors who have joy for this profession. So we're handing it down to the next generation in a dismal state. So they almost have to recreate it. It's very sad. That's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book to allow people to experience the joy of a physician, which I guess people feel is impossible in 2013. Nobody's seen it. So I wanted to put it at least in book form if people couldn't all come to my office and experience it personally.
You're listening to Dr. Pamela Weibel. She's a family physician practicing in Eugene, Oregon. Her book is Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind. In addition to her practice and her advocacy for community-designed healthcare, Dr. Weibel offers biannual retreats to help prevent physician burnout, depression, and suicide.
Well, you know, I especially appreciated Dr. Weibel's remarks about humans are not cars. You know, we don't need to go in to get our muffler or our oil changed. What we need is a human experience with another human, a physician.
Well, exactly. And the idea that people around the country want overwhelmingly to be treated as human beings, that doesn't seem too much to ask.
No, we're much more than our numbers or our gallbladders.
And it's a great idea that we would be able to help the next generation of doctors see that indeed that's possible. Not only is it possible for them to treat their patients as human beings, when they do, they in turn have the reward of being treated like human beings.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll find out how patients can help teach the next generation of doctors to be healers.
Do examining rooms have to be so scary? What could be done to change that?
And we'll find out what you can do if you feel your doctor isn't paying attention to you.
Dr. Weibel sometimes sees patients outside the office, at the grocery store, the DMV, or the YMCA. Is that something you would welcome?
How are guidelines for medical practice sometimes used as a barrier to really good care? The usual way medical practices are set up these days requires doctors to see far more patients in a day than may be comfortable for either them or their patients. We're looking at a different way to approach healthcare in a community.
We're talking today with Dr. Pamela Weibel. She is an innovator in patient-centered care. Her book is Pet Goats and Pap Smears. Dr. Weibel, you were just talking about the need for medical students to be taught about primary care practice in a practical way while they're, you know, learning medicine. And you have actually done some of that teaching yourself in it. Unusual approach, of course. Would you please tell us about that?
Well, to understand this, I need to just share a bit about the book I wrote, which is, it's called Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind. And these are my best 101 patient stories from 20 years of medical practice. And these are just beautiful patients who otherwise their stories would be lost to history. I have a whole section on patients who have died, and, you know, I was with them on their deathbed, and they literally, you know, I carry the stories of their lives with me. So they're beautiful tales of patients. You know, I have patients who are in prison. I have patients who are sex workers. I have patients who have really interesting stories, and they all have consented for me to actually even use their real first names in the book. And during the consent process, I specifically asked each patient if they would mind having media interviews and being involved in teaching the next generation of doctors. I mean, that's why I offer these stories, to teach patients and physicians of the next generation. And they unanimously, for the most part, consented. So when it came time to teach at the medical school, which we have opening, it was 2 years ago, just opened about an hour away, the new medical school in Oregon, I gave books to all the faculty, all the students for free, and then they invited me there to speak. I brought and about five of my patients who I had turned into chapter stars in the book to teach at the medical school. And these patients include, you know, a postal worker who had uncontrollable diarrhea, a sex worker, and, you know, people who have never actually publicly spoken or taught medical school, and people who in public speaking could risk going to jail. I mean, a sex worker, right? But they were willing to come with me to medical school, hold the microphone, work the room like Phil Donahue, It was beautiful. Answer questions of first and second year medical students, which were also streaming live to their Pomona campus in California. So it was just a beautiful thing to watch patients teaching the next generation of doctors how to be healers.
What kinds of questions did the medical students have for your patients?
Well, they wanted to know how you would relate to somebody who has such a different lifestyle, for example. How do you not alienate somebody who comes in who is a sex worker, for example? Some people don't know, how you would make a clinic welcoming for people who otherwise may not seek medical care. And so so this woman was incredible, what she shared. And
Can you give us an example?
She said, when you advertise a medical clinic, don't use, Times New Roman font and make it look very serious and sterile. Have it look fun. Put pink in there. Put some colors. Put some pillows around the room. Make it look homey. Actually welcoming, somewhat like a living room would look in somebody's, sweet little studio apartment. And
that really does raise the question as to why examining rooms can be so scary. I mean, it's not just that they're sterile, it's they're scary. And there you are in your little paper gown with your bottom hanging out, feeling extremely vulnerable. And you wonder, well, why aren't there some pictures on the wall? Why isn't there something in here to make me feel less uncomfortable?
Right. I think it's just that factory medicine mentality, this industrialization of a career that's really meant to have more of the human spirit. You can't industrialize and mass produce the human spirit.
Is there anything a patient can do if the doctor doesn't seem to be paying attention?
First of all, I know it's hard because some patients do not feel a sense of compassion for their physicians. They feel they might be, greedy and just cold sometimes. But actually, if patients could start having a little bit of empathy for physicians as people who are humanitarians that were trained to be more like reductionist robots. I mean, this is not naturally what they had necessarily envisioned when they signed up for medical school. So you have physicians that were dehumanized, and what you want to do is when you go to the doctor, you want to connect with them on a human level so that you can then receive what they can provide for you on those other levels, not just the physical. So what's important to do is make eye contact, sit at the same level or stand at the same level, hug, do something at the beginning of the appointment to jolt them out of this robotic assembly line mentality, which just means touching them at a spirit level. And that could be starting with a joke, or asking them to take off their white coat that you would feel more comfortable if that's the case. Or, one elderly woman told me, she was in one of these fast visits with a patient, with a physician, and she asked him, well, how much time do we have? And he said, 10 minutes. And she said, I'd like you to take your shoes off, put your feet up on the desk, take off your coat, and just look me in the eyes and talk to me like I'm your mother or grandmother. And so just giving a little bit of instruction about what type of interaction you'd like to have. I mean, the doctor is there to serve you. And like I said, even if you only have 10 minutes, a lot of beauty can happen in a short period of time. So it's just setting the tone.
Now, there is a huge controversy in medicine right now about the annual checkup. We've been told over the last 30 or 40 years that, you just have to go in and see your doctor every year and have the doctor thump on your chest and listen to your lungs and hit your knee with that little hammer and look in your ears and get your blood tested. And now there are people who are saying, waste of time. It doesn't make a difference. Doesn't improve mortality statistics, whether you go in or whether you don't go in. And so there's this whole sort of tension between the concept of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure versus if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And one physician we talked to said, well, she's loath to give up the annual checkup, but rather than a checkup, she'd rather have it be a check-in. That is to say, communication, find out how things are going rather than run through some pre-specified number of things that need to be done.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I do like the check-in idea. I don't necessarily, you know, require, even suggest people do this yearly, because what we need is a very personalized view of the patient and their entire story. And some people, you know, they don't need to come in every year. There's nothing that we specifically need to do for them. You know, healthy young teenagers, you know, they can be fine, you know, beyond 1 year. Although if there's a problem, what would encourage them to come in is that human connection with the doctor. You know, to get a teenager to ask to come to the doctor is not going to happen, you know, by the old kind of cold, sterile approach. It's just that human relationship, the checking in, that keeps the open door available for people when they need it. And yeah, there are certain ages that maybe need certain tests at lesser intervals than we once thought. You know, pap smears, for example, can be every 5 years, you know, if we do co-testing with HPV. And so women are actually kind of confused. Oh, I don't need to come in every year for a pap smear, you know. Well, no, not every year for a pap smear. Maybe we'd do other things, you know, check the internal organs for other sorts of issues. But it's very individual. So I don't recommend a yearly exam. I recommend that every person and I come up with something that makes sense for them and their personal circumstance.
Absolutely. I think, Dr. Weibel, that a lot of people have this kind of relationship with their veterinarians. You're talking about, you know, a human connection, a visit in which there's time to check in, how are things going, and doesn't necessarily feel like a big rush. And yet it seems as if the person who's taking care of your dog, your cat, or your pet goat can do this, presumably your doctor could figure it out as well, right?
Yep, and that's been mentioned at the town hall meeting. Some people said I would like to be treated as well as my goat, you know, and that's a pretty dramatic comment when you think about it, that, you know, we're actually treating farm animals better than human beings in their time of need.
You talk about, in a sense, providing medical care in some odd places, including the grocery store, the YMCA, and the DMV. How in the world?
Well, what I try to do is be in relationship with my patients. So when my patients call, and I'm a solo doctor, so I have no staff, and I have no other doctors I work with, but when a patient calls in need, you know, for something on a Saturday, and I'm at my nephew's basketball game at the YMCA, and I know that it's something that doesn't require stitches, and it's just, it was a bad case of poison oak in that case, I said, well, just, you know, drop by the Y. And so I literally was able to not miss a beat in my nephew's basketball game, watch him dunk the ball, and examine a child with poison oak and prescribe medication to deal with that. Then I went to a grocery store one night, and a patient was really upset. The guy lives in the woods, is uninsured, a poor guy. He thought he had cancer. He told me he thought he had cancer, and I, of course, said, you know, wanted to know more. I don't want to leave him, you know, anxious in the middle of the pasta aisle there. And he showed me a spot on his hand. Well, I was able to tell him in about 10 seconds that's not cancer. And just, there's no reason why I should force somebody to make an appointment to do something that can be handled so easily and for free. I mean, he offered me $10, but I said, really, it took me 10 seconds. It's unnecessary. And so, and the other one, oh, the DMV, the guy had injured his finger. Again, I didn't think it required stitches, and I was already at the DMV, and I knew he lived around the corner. It would make far less sense to have him make an appointment and travel 3 miles across town to my office and me as well than to say, well, I'm waiting at the DMV, just come right over. He needed to transfer a car title. So he came over, we sat together under the same number and went up to the desk and handled all our business at once. Plus, I examined his finger and was able to treat him. So it's just being present and willing to connect at a human level and do what makes sense.
It does sound like that, and it sounds like you offer yourself a great deal of flexibility, which really serves your patients as well.
it makes my life easier. What would look as it would look more difficult, or maybe a burden. Oh, on your time off, you have to see patients, you know, at the grocery store. But really, if you think about it, it decreases your burden. To be available to people ultimately decreases your burden if you have good boundaries.
Now, speaking of being available to people, here's a question we've been asking many doctors we talk to lately. Do you do email correspondence with your patients?
Yeah, I do email correspondence and, you know, phone call, whatever people need, house calls, of course, I'll pretty much try anything. And, And the thing is, another issue that is worth mentioning is that it's not just these town hall meetings in which I ask people, you know, how to design an ideal clinic. It's when people call for appointments and they want to have a physical. I ask them, well, what would make this an ideal physical? And they say, if I could bring my best friend with me. And I say, fine, you know, bring all your friends. That's fine with me. I mean, as long as we can fit in the room. And so this one particular woman, you know, she brought her best friend. She made a day of it, girls' day out. They came with, you know, dressed up and went out to lunch. I had party hats there and balloons. We made it into like a little party, you know, what you would imagine as probably a middle school, you know, slumber party type of an atmosphere. But, you know, with grown women who are, you know, doing an exam, I taught each one how to screen the other for melanoma and how to even do each other's pap smears. And I know that sounds kind of odd. But this is what my patients want. They want to understand how their bodies work. They want to understand what to look for. And, you know, some women are single. They're you know, in their 50s, and the only person looking at their back is their best friend. You know what I mean? And so to have some instruction on what to look for, what is melanoma, what is skin cancer, it kind of creates more self-reliance in patients, so they don't need as many appointments. And we certainly had a fun time.
Pamela, you've talked a little bit about the one-size-fits-all versus the personalized medicine model that you are advocating. But so many physicians feel that they have to practice medicine by the guidelines. You know, some expert committee someplace came up with, you know, kind of a list of things that you're supposed to do when a patient has X, Y, or Z. And if you don't practice by the guidelines, you're going to get penalized. How do you deal with that?
Well, guidelines are just guidelines, meaning that, you know, you look at them as a guide and you make the decision that's appropriate for the case that you're involved in, which may stray from the guidelines. I think a lot of the fear of straying from the guidelines comes from a fear of being sued. Now, when you analyze why physicians are sued, they're not necessarily sued for bad outcomes. What people do, and this is an amazing story that I heard at a malpractice conference I went to on, you know, breaking out of defensive medicine, is that this one woman had a bad outcome, and she decided to sue and went to an attorney. And the attorney presented her with a list of 20 physicians, you know, scoured her chart for every name in there, and asked her, you know, is it okay, I'm going to proceed with, you know, a suit on these 20 physicians. She looked through the list. She said, you can take all of them except this one. And he said, why? And she said, that's my family doctor. I like this doctor. So it's a personal relationship that will save you from a lawsuit. That's been shown over and over again. It's that connection, and people don't want to harm a relationship that they love.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to find out some ways to rectify the lack of connection in modern medicine.
Dr. Weibel has a tale of two testicles to tell.
Two testicles?
Uh-huh. You want to stay tuned for that.
Do tell. You'll also learn about three trends to look out for in making better patient-centered care, making care more personalized, a shift to partnership, and a change from a reductionist medical model to an integrative approach. Our topic today is how communities could design their own clinics and how that might work for both doctors and patients. How can they work together?
We're talking with Dr. Pamela Weibel. She's a nationally recognized innovator in patient-centered care. She pioneered the community-centered ideal medical practice. And she wrote Pet Goats and Pap Smears.
Dr. Weibel, one of the challenges today, because of time pressure, because of all of the other complications of complex medicine, communication seems to be one of the biggest complaints. We've talked about it already, lack of time, but also just the lack of connecting and how people often don't understand each other. One example I heard of many years ago was a woman who took a quick look at her medical record as the doctor stepped out of the room and saw a reference to grossly symmetrical breasts. And that scared the heck out of her because she saw the word gross. And all she could think of was, oh, you know, my doctor thinks my breasts are gross.
Wow.
What's wrong with them? And you talk about a story in your book about testicles. Could you tell us about it?
Oh, yes. A Tale of Two Testicles. I actually did a video on this yesterday. It's posted on YouTube. I know that story well. Yeah, this was essentially a retired police officer who called me for an urgent appointment. And so, you know, I said, sure, come right over. He was in obvious distress when he arrived. And, you know, he said he basically, the story goes, I got to show you something, doc. We go to the exam room. I turn on the exam light, I put on gloves, and he pulls his pants down, points to his left testicle, I lean in real close, and what's the problem, I ask. And he's like, look, doc, can't you see? What? My left testicle is hanging real low. That's it? You know, no pain? I mean, really, everything looked normal. But he was obviously concerned and really distressed. So I stood up and I explained to him something that I explained to people over and over again, which is why it became a story in the book. I explained that, you know, here's the deal. Most people hang lower on the left. In women, the left breast is slightly larger and hangs lower. And for men, the left testicle generally hangs lower. You know, so you're in with the main crowd. This guy was thrilled. He was so relieved. He handed me his copay with a $5 tip. And on the way out, I went ahead and added, which is kind of funny. But I thought he needed to know that, you know, just so you know, most curvy penises also curve to the left. And these are things that people might wonder about, or I'm sure men might think, maybe I'm the only one that looks this way. And to be relieved that, no, the majority of men look that way. I'm sure men aren't comparing themselves to one another, you know, routinely, you know, in an erect form, right? So to know that, no, that's normal. Even when I recorded this, my videographer told me after I recorded this that he was relieved, that he's been wondering the same thing about his testicles, that he's uninsured, and so he didn't go to the doctor to, of course, ask what might seem like a stupid question. But these are things that people wonder about. And I even explained this to a friend of mine, basically kind of like an adopted brother who's a truck driver in Texas. And he's been wondering the same thing, and I tell him, you know, we know more about our cars than we do about our bodies. Why is that? You know?
It doesn't seem right.
It doesn't.
So, Pamela, what are we to make of this breakdown in communication? I mean, you are demonstrating how you have created an environment where people can ask these personal, sometimes scary questions in a way that doesn't faze you and makes them feel like, hey, it's okay. But there are a lot of other health professionals who haven't figured this out yet. So what's the message that you would like them to understand and the message that you would like patients to take away?
Just one message is that what we have now is a real fear-based predatory disease billing system. That's what I would call what we have now. And what we're trying to move toward is a holistic, personalized, more... just a model in which we actually can care and provide health for one another. And the way we're going to do that first, the primary thing we need to do is break out of this cycle of fear. You know, physicians are afraid of patients. They're afraid they're going to get sued. They're afraid they're not going to do the right thing. They're afraid they're going to kill somebody. You know, patients are afraid of their doctors. Can they afford the bill? Can they afford to go? Is the guy even going to listen to them? And so we get in this cycle of fear, and I think we're in almost a fight or flight mode during a medical visit. And it's just a simple shift. You know, don't take it so seriously. Back up a little bit. Connect with each other. When you have these conversations about testicles and penises, you're going to laugh. You know, it's funny that people are asking these questions in the end, right? I mean, you're going to leave in a good mood. This guy always leaves laughing because he learned something from me, you know? But he's really kind of a high anxiety type of a police officer. And so the thing is, it's nice to have a fearless and loving encounter. And it's just a simple shift in one's mind. You know, when you walk into the room with the doctor, don't be afraid. Connect. You know, the physician, approach a patient as a friend. You know, that's what people say in the town hall meetings. They want a doctor somebody who they feel like is a friend who happens to be their doctor. So I think that's what we want to create, but it's a mental shift.
Pamela, you described three trends that are impacting the way medical care is delivered. Can you explain what they are and why they're relevant to what we're talking about right now?
Well, the first thing is, you know, we've been handed down a medical model that doesn't quite work in 2013. And one of the transitions is we're going from what is a patriarchal, paternalistic model to a partnership model. And so where, you know, and some people aren't comfortable with this. I've heard a doctor say we used to be a sage on the stage and now we're a guide from the side. But really, this is 2013. This is what people want. They don't want that medical hierarchy. The other thing is moving from a one-size-fits-all to a personalized care model. Meaning, you know, this is the touches on the, you know, the annual physical exam. We don't need a one-size-fits-all model because we're not all one size. We don't all need the same thing. And so it's just a matter of getting back to the patient's needs and what makes sense for them. And the third is moving from a reductionist to a holistic model. And that's the number two issue that comes up in the town hall meetings over and over again is people want an integrative approach. And what they mean by that is they don't want to have to look on Google for their acupuncturist and massage therapist. They want their doctor to be communicating with all these other professionals and really deliver a holistic treatment plan. You know, gee, if I can't help you with fibromyalgia, maybe call Joe. He's really good at craniosacral or Reiki, or try this, you know, and just to be able to offer something else if you don't have anything else to offer. And so, yeah, those are the three things, the patriarchal to the partnership, the one-size-fits-all to a personalized care model, and reductionist to holistic medicine.
Now, Dr. Weibel, I'd like to talk just a little bit more about the idea of shifting to a partnership relationship for healthcare. It's something that appeals to me a great deal, but I can imagine that you're going to get some self-selection of patients there. Not everyone's going to be comfortable with a partnership model, are they?
Well, it is generational. I did have one very funny experience with an older woman who came to see me back in around 2000, and I offered her an array of treatment options for her urinary tract infection, you know, herbs and lifestyle and, you know, medication. And in the end, she looked at me, leaned forward, and said, "What's the matter, honey? You don't know what you're doing?" And so, you know, some people like the patriarchal, paternalistic type of model, and it's up to me. This is the art of medicine. I need to sense that. I need to sense that the right thing to tell this woman is, here, take this medicine twice a day for 3 days, pat her on the back and smile. That's what she wanted. You know, it was instructional for me. I thought it was funny. But so some generations prefer that, and that's fine. And I think there is a gender difference in what physicians want to deliver and what patients want to receive. You know, women are much more into, you know, relational and talking. I mean, a woman could spend 45 minutes talking about menopause, and let me tell you, a man might not want to listen.
I can well imagine that.
And so, and that's a male doctor might not want to listen. Now, a male physician might take things, you know, very quickly with a male patient comes in for strep throat. He obviously just wants to get checked, get the antibiotics, not a lot of chit-chat, you know. That was something I needed to learn because when I opened my own clinic, which I did once before for all uninsured out of my house back in when I was 29, just a little experiment and, you know, in ideal healthcare. And I was giving 60-minute appointments to everyone on their first visit, and I realized that the men whom I saw felt that I was flirting with them. Because honestly, you know, to sit alone in a room with a nicer-looking younger woman who's leaning forward and taking incredible interest in your personal life and how you feel about your job and your health and how's, you know, your sex life and how's your relationship. I mean, that could seem like flirting, right?
Well, it could seem uncomfortably intimate, yes, especially
right.
if it's the very first time you've met this person.
Right. And so the thing is, this is part of the art. I mean, this is an apprenticeship profession, and you kind of learn on the job. That's why you call it practicing medicine, because, you know, that was great practice to realize, you know what, men really don't want 60-minute appointments unless they need it for something more complicated, and they probably want to stay possibly more in the reductionist realm with just the details of what the treatment plan is and not a lot of talk about, you know, do they love their job or not and their wife. And, you know, they don't want to go into – some people don't want to go into that. Women universally love going into these topics. So it's just good for me to know and for physicians to know that different people want different sorts of services. Some people don't want a partnership model. Some people want a direct answer and they want to get out of the room. Some people want you to pat them on the back and hand them a pill. But most people really is shifting. Most people, especially younger generations and women, love this partnership model, which, by the way, 70% of all office visits are women. So to hold women hostage to, you know, a paternalistic system doesn't make sense.
Now, there are a lot of women who are listening to us right now going, oh, I only wish my physician was willing to listen to me. You know, there are a lot of male doctors who are very comfortable with the old paradigm, with that old, you know, paternalistic, patriarchal approach where they're on a pedestal and don't question my authority.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that if their patients like receiving that type of care. I think what we need to know is that there's someone for everyone, like they say with marriage, right? You wait long enough, there's someone for everyone. And so if your doctor is not working for you, find another doctor, you know? You don't want to create tension in a relationship that's supposed to be healing for both parties. You know, tension in and of itself is not worth it. So I say move on to another doctor. And now a lot of doctors feel trapped and they're practicing in a paternalistic model and they'd rather be in a partnership model. In that case, I'll give you my book for free. You know, it's easy to do. I teach retreats, full scholarships for everyone who wants to come. I mean, I try to promote this in a way where it's accessible for everyone. I'm not doing this for money. I love what I do. My work is a labor of love. And essentially, I feel like the way to heal healthcare is just by example, you know, by loving my patients, by loving my job and writing these stories and, you know, speaking on shows such as this and letting people know there is another way. If you're not happy where you are receiving health care, then maybe it's not health care.
And Dr. Weibel, you say that you have held these community town halls in Oregon and in Wisconsin. Are there other places around the country where others are taking on this approach?
Yes, at these retreats where I've trained other physicians how to do this, because believe me, we don't learn community organizing or business skills in medical school. They've gone back to Colorado, Alaska, different places to hold their town hall meetings. And I'm really excited now because one of the last graduates of our little 2-3-day retreat that I led earlier last year, they're leading town hall meetings in Salem, Oregon now, which is the capital of Oregon. So I'm going to actually, this is so exciting, I'm going to get to attend one as a participant for the first time. I've been leading them for 8 years and I've never been able to attend one. So I'm really like kind of jumping out of my skin for that. So yeah, they're happening all over the country, and it's just a matter of looking around and keeping your eyes open. I think it's going to happen more and more. I've got people at the next retreat coming from Canada, Mexico, Alaska. You know, this is something that's really catching on because, honestly, waiting for the government or, you know, D.C. to come down with mandates for us and more regulations is not really what people want. People often have at their fingertips solutions that can be developed that are more in alignment with their values at the community level. And I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm just saying waiting for the solution to come universally to everyone from Washington, D.C. is not the best method, especially because we want to break out of the one-size-fits-all and get to the personalized, community-driven care that people really want to receive.
Dr. Pamela Weibel, thank you so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was really fun, and people can feel free to contact me if they like, and I return all my emails, so don't feel trapped. If you need help, I can certainly help you develop a model wherever you are for community-designed healthcare.
You've been listening to Dr. Pamela Weibel. She's a family physician practicing in Eugene, Oregon, and an innovator in community-focused medical care. Her book is Pet Goats and Pap Smears, 101 Medical Adventures to Open Your Heart and Mind. Dr. Weibel offers biannual retreats to help prevent physician burnout, depression, and suicide. You'll find her website at idealmedicalcare.org.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.